From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Mass outpourings of grief for influencer Charlie Kirk on Florida's college and university campuses.
I would say this has definitely caused a lot of people to rethink their decisions, rethink their political affiliations.
Also this week, state education officials tell school districts to send special memos to teachers,
warning them to, like, quote, govern themselves when it came to social media posts about Charlie Kirk.
We'll also hear from a former Florida Surgeon General on the matter of childhood vaccine mandates, and we'll head to what were the world's most famous oyster beds to see if there's any hope for their future. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end of week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. More than 1,000 people stood in line at the University of South Florida to attend a Monday night vigil for slain conservative activist Charlie Kirk. WUSF Steve Newborn spoke with some attendees.
Christina Montalegre, a sophomore studying biology at USF, saw Kirk when he came to the university with Turning Point USA in February. She says she hopes Kirk's assassination can teach people to resolve their differences peacefully.
I live in a residence hall, and usually it's pretty divided, but I would say this has definitely caused a lot of people to rethink their decisions, rethink their political affiliations. People think that violence really isn't an answer on both sides of the spectrum.
Kirk toured college campuses debating students. Along the way, he made several controversial statements about women and minorities, but he drew large support from conservatives, especially among young Christians. Joshua Scacco is a political science professor at USF. He says young people were drawn to his message for several reasons.
It could very well be shared sort of religious affinity and identity that attracts people to him. An additional component may very well be our media environment encourages people to find like-minded others.
Josh Halb, a student at Florida College in Temple Terrace, said he was leaning on his faith to help him deal with Kirk's assassination.
We're looking to handle these things the way Charlie would have wanted us to, and the way that the Bible calls us to. And it calls us to pray for our enemies, to love those who persecute us and who do all sorts of evil against us.
Members of the press were not permitted to attend the vigil. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
Meanwhile, a prominent free speech advocacy group is criticizing the suspension of Jimmy Kimmel and several Florida teachers for their comments on the assassination of conservative commentator Charlie Kirk. More on that story from Tristan Wood.
I think that that's wrong, and it creates very clear First Amendment problems when the government is pressuring a broadcaster to sideline a late-night comedian for what he says.
Adam Steinpaugh is a senior attorney with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a free speech advocacy group. He's talking about the suspension of late-night host Jimmy Kimmel, who was suspended from air by ABC for comments he made about the assassination of Charlie Kirk. This comes after Federal Communications Chair Brendan Carr called for his removal.
I mean, look, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. These companies can find ways to change conduct, to take action, frankly, on Kimmel, or, you know, there's going to be additional work for the FCC. Again, there's actions that we can take on licensed broadcasters. And frankly, I think that it's really sort of past time that a lot of these licensed broadcasters themselves push back on Comcast and Disney and say, listen, we are going to preempt. We are not going to run Kimmel anymore until you straighten this out, because we licensed broadcaster are running the possibility of fines or license revocation from the FCC if we continue to run content that ends up being a pattern of news distortion.
Steinbaugh says it's wrong for the federal government to pressure private companies for speech because of First Amendment protections.
ABC is doing this under pressure from the federal government. You have the chairman of the FCC who is in the process of reviewing proposed mergers involving companies connected to ABC or to Disney, saying we can do this the easy way or the hard way, and claiming that Jimmy Kimmel talking about this on air is not in the public interest.
Teachers in Florida have been suspended for their comments as well. Stephen Walker is an education reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. He's been following the cases of Florida teachers that have been suspended for their off-the-clock comments about Kirk's death.
On September 11th, the State Commissioner of Education sent a memo to districts in order to have them forward it to teachers, warning them to, like, quote, govern themselves when it came to social media posts about Charlie Kirk.
Four teachers have been suspended in Osceola County. Governor Ron DeSantis has supported those suspensions.
Well, I mean, people say, oh, well, you know, people can do what they want, free speech. Well, yeah, no one's saying the government's going to put you in jail for doing that. But I do think it's a problem. Is that someone you want teaching your kids when they say that this is something, this assassination should be celebrated? Of course not.
Steinbaugh thinks those Florida cases also have cause for concern.
Your private company can take action against you for what you say on the clock or off the clock, with certain limited exceptions. But if your employer is a government entity and it is taking action against you based on something you said off the clock and about a matter of public concern, that raises First Amendment problems. Even if your speech is offensive, even if your speech angers members of the public, people have the right to say things and to espouse opinions that are offensive to other people.
Fire Steinbaugh says both the Kimmel suspension and the teacher suspensions set a dangerous precedent for both political parties.
The First Amendment protects everyone. And if we start watering it down to go after the speech we don't like, then it's not going to be there for the speech that we do like. Because the tools, the theories, the legal principles that you set for offensive speech today are going to be used against the speech tomorrow. And it might be speech you like.
Watch the full video on this topic at WFSU.org. I'm Tristan Wood.
Coming up on Capitol Report, while Florida's current surge in general is pushing to do away with vaccine mandates for school kids, his predecessor is urging caution.
If we start unwinding the things that keep children safe and healthy in school, there will be real educational consequences. There are going to be real health consequences.
We'll hear about some plans that could reduce or even do away with Florida property taxes.
It is the largest tax source. It's even larger than the state sales tax.
Dave Ehrenberg helped shut down the state's pill mills. Now he's trying to chase the scammers out of the addiction recovery business.
And instead of trying to get them well, what they would do is commoditize them. They kept them in an unending series of relapses rather than recovery.
And the good news, Florida's most iconic oyster beds are reopening, but the bad news is that things are not as they once were.
There's a lot of oysters, but it's not as good as it was. We don't have 10,000 acres like we used to, no.
Florida's former Surgeon General Scott Rivkes is speaking out against a proposal to remove vaccine mandates for school children. He describes the actions by Florida's current Surgeon General, Joseph Latipo, as dangerous for the public's health. Rivkes spoke with WUSF's Kerry Sheridan about an editorial he wrote in the Tampa Bay Times asking why Florida is going backwards when it comes to childhood vaccines.
What made you want to write this?
I think that what's happening in Florida in terms of his current recommendations are worrisome, not just for children, but for all people living in the state of Florida. It actually has implications beyond Florida. I mean, one of the things we know is that vaccines are just an amazing public health success, and anything that undermines vaccination is going to have an impact on children and actually on the community at large. I've cared for many other children who suffered from, some of whom died from, diseases that are now vaccine preventable. And to think that we can wind the hands of the clock back in time, that we're going to now start seeing children suffer from chickenpox, Haemophilus influenza, hepatitis B, pneumococcal disease, it really shouldn't be that way.
And you point out that the Florida Department of Health should do projection of what the impacts of this decision would be, and they haven't.
The Florida Department of Health is a great department. They have great epidemiology. They can certainly make these types of projections. But we know what cases were in the pre-vaccination era. So information is out there. Even just a couple months ago, there was an excellent study that came out at Stanford University looking at if vaccination rates, just focusing on measles, go down by 10% nationally, we'll be talking about more than 11 million cases of measles over the next 20, 25 years. And in Florida, this means that there could be more than a million new cases of measles as well. If vaccination rates just drop 10% from current levels of about 92%.
And you mentioned in your editorial that you see leaders ignoring these principles for the sake of political ideology. Are you saying that Dr. Latipo is doing that?
Dr. Latipo has made some very different stances from the rest of the public health community. So, for example, you know, one of the first things that he announced was that healthy children should not get vaccinated against COVID, even though the medical community was in agreement with that. You know, during the pandemic, 2,000 children died from COVID. While I was in Surgeon General there, and I reviewed every one of those sad death certificates, and most of these children did not have underlying medical conditions. So this viewpoint was not adopted by any other state. And then last year, he announced that no individuals in Florida should have a messenger RNA vaccine, young or old, without telling older individuals who are most at risk for COVID as far as what to do. No other state has adopted those guidelines. So the viewpoints that he has put forth are not in keeping with mainstream medicine.
The argument that some of the people who are against vaccines make is, well, it's my choice. So what do you say to that?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, in terms of vaccines, I understand the personal choice and personal freedom argument, but vaccines need to have two things that work. First, parents need to vaccinate their children. And for that child to be protected, you're also dependent on other parents vaccinating their child as well. And this is why every state in this country has vaccine mandates. This is something that society has decided, and the Supreme Court has decided this as well.
What do you think can be done to turn this around?
Parents need to reflect on the fact that when they vaccinate their child, they're not just protecting their child, they're protecting other children as well. You know, we're in a community, we're in a society, we need to look out for each other. And, you know, let's not go to a situation where everybody's just looking out for themselves.
Well, Dr. Scott Rifke is a pediatrician, professor of practice at the Brown University School of Public Health, and the former Surgeon General of Florida. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate you reaching out.
That was WUSF's Kerry Sheridan speaking with former Florida Surgeon General Scott Rifke. As Florida Governor Ron DeSantis heads into his final year as the state's chief executive, he still has a lot of unfinished business. One of his big goals is to do away with the state's property tax. And since it will take an amendment to Florida's Constitution to make that happen, he'll need the help of the state legislature during the 2026 session to put it on the ballot. But some lawmakers, and certainly the counties, cities, and school districts that depend so much on property tax revenue, are more than a little reluctant to dump the tax completely. But Florida Tax Watch, an independent tax research and watchdog organization in Tallahassee, has helpfully provided some options. And they were rolled out today, just 3 days before the Florida House Select Committee on Property Taxes meets to consider the whole matter. Here's Tax Watch Executive Vice President and Legal Counsel Jeff Kottkamp. You may recall he was Lieutenant Governor when Charlie Crist was governor. He kicked off the media call, rolling out the alternatives.
An analysis of five options that the legislature may consider as they move forward with property tax reform. We'll talk about some of the benefits and some of the risk of each of the options.
TaxWatch Senior Vice President of Research Kurt Wenner acknowledges the importance of property taxes to local governments in the state.
Property tax does raise $55 billion a year. It is the largest tax source. It's even larger than the state. sales tax. It's a significant moneymaker for local governments and schools, and a burden for a lot of taxpayers in Florida.
Overall, they comprise 18% of county revenues, 17% of municipal revenues, and a whopping 50 to 60% of school district revenue. Still, TaxWatch VP of Research Brandy Gunder believes the pluses of reform outweigh the minuses.
Each option has significant benefits, like incentivizing homeownership, but all come with substantial trade-offs that require local governments to analyze current budgets and community needs and institute strong fiscal policies and management to ensure critical government services are delivered without merely shifting the burden to non-homestead properties.
And her colleague Kurt Wenner has an answer for those local governments that say increases in population and inflation make property tax hikes inevitable.
Population inflation isn't a perfect measure of the cost of government services, but as you can see, the combined effects of population growth and inflation, property taxes have exceeded it considerably.
It seems likely, therefore, that the Tax Watch suggestions will find their way into not only Monday's House committee meeting, but also the governor's office, says Jeff Kottkamp.
We anticipate working with Governor DeSantis and the legislature to share our research in order to be a resource and ensure that we increase accountability for every taxpayer dollar that is spent and ensure the greatest possible return for the taxpayers of Florida.
More on this as the issue develops. Former state lawmaker and former Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg is talking about his new book, Fighting the Florida Shuffle. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Hamm podcast, he gives an inside scoop on corruption in the drug treatment industry and offers some tweaks for Congress to boost patient protection. Here's an excerpt.
It took me 4 years to write the book. It identifies the problem of the Florida Shuffle, which is not only that there's fraud and abuse in the drug treatment industry, but what's really a scandal is that well-intended federal laws actually fuel this corruption.
Yeah, it was interesting because I downloaded your book. I bought it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, there's really 0 degrees of separation with this issue nowadays. And I think that's part of why it became so imperative for the legislature to act on it, right? Because so many people were directly impacted by this pill mill epidemic. But what you're talking about is it's sort of the next level, right? And you guys fixed it in Palm Beach County. It isn't fixed really in Florida statewide, is it?
We fixed it in the county, but there are no walls around our border. So the corrupted drug treatment that fled our community were able to go elsewhere. Most communities don't even know what the Florida Shuffle is. And unless you have a task force, which we do, there's not a concentrated law enforcement effort targeted at taking them down. So we made 121 arrests in 5 years. We put handcuffs on so many of these bad players in the industry, these rogue players in the industry, because a lot of the players in the industry are good. We worked with them, but the unscrupulous ones were giving the industry a bad name and causing so many unnecessary deaths. I mean, people all around the country would come down to Florida to get well and instead would leave in an ambulance or a body bag.
I think at one point, didn't like Delray Beach have more treatment centers, you know, than any place else in the country? I forget what the statistic was.
Delray Beach was ground zero because they always had a thriving drug treatment industry. It's like the adage, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Mm-hmm. So when the Affordable Care Act passed, and the people want to make real money off it, decided to exploit people in recovery. Where do they go? They go to Delray Beach in Florida, where they had a number of people in recovery. And instead of trying to get them well, what they would do is commoditize them. They kept them in an unending series of relapses rather than recovery because the money was not in sobriety. The money was in failure. Mm. And unlike other types of healthcare, so for example, if you had a broken arm and went to a doctor, and the doctor said, Dara, keep coming back here every month. We're going to set your arm and then break it again, and we're going to get money from insurance, and I'll give you a $1,000 kickback every time you come. You would say, get lost, I'm calling the cops. But when you have the brain disease of addiction, substance use disorder, you're often a willing victim. You'd be like, okay, I'll get drugs from you, I'll get money, I'll get free housing, and I don't have to go home to a snowy climate and live with my parents and find a job. And all I have to do is just relapse and give my brain what it's craving. Yes, please. And that is the Florida shuffle. Really, the insidiousness of this is that you have people who are exploiting others at the lowest stages of their lives. This is not an anonymous statistic. And that's the thing. Mm-hmm. We all prey into this, where we just say, well, these are addicts, these are users, they want to be there, or the statistics, yeah, they're just some number. No, this is someone's daughter, someone's wife, someone's child, someone's mother. And you know, losing someone like that is the loss of the entire world to someone. And that's why I wanted it to be known to me and everyone else that these people are worth saving. And that's the thing, unfortunately, with the stigma with substance use disorder.
Still,
yep, is that there is a belief, and I've talked to many groups, and I've had groups of people who otherwise caring individuals who, mm-hmm, are saying, why do we care?
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Exactly. But your brain changes. And, you know, most of these people get involved with these opioids because they go to a doctor and innocently get prescribed this, yes, stuff, because you had a multinational corporation, Purdue Pharma, mm-hmm, market their drugs like it's Advil. And they have a marketing campaign to sell it to people as a drug of first resort when it should never be used first. It should be used as like an end-stage cancer treatment or when nothing else works. And here they are creating millions of addicts from a drug, and they're making billions of dollars of it. Yeah. And we're blaming those who succumb to this marketing campaign. Like, they're the problem.
Yeah.
So that's why I tried to show that this is not a moral failing. It's a brain disease.
That was former Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after 5 years, the state of Florida could soon reopen the Apalachicola Bay to harvesting wild oysters with tongs. While the bay's been closed, oyster reefs have slowly been regrowing, but that's not all. Aquaculture oyster farming has been putting down roots there as well. Now, as the state moves forward with its plans to restore the bay, some are questioning what's next for Apalachicola oysters, which once comprised 90% of Florida's oyster supply. Margie Menzel reports.
Sochi Rivera and Kung Lee are taking their boat out to their aquaculture oyster farm. They leased the space, which is in the Apalachicola Bay, from the state. Rivera says they grow the oysters from so-called seeds.
They're about the size of your fingernail when they start, and so about 75,000 fit into 5 or 6 bags. And then they grow and grow, and each time you start moving them into bigger bags with bigger holes so they can eat more, and you end up with bags of, you know, the full-size, market-ready, 3-inch oysters, about 100 per bag.
On this day, they're pulling plastic mesh bags filled with growing oysters out of the water and onto their boat to sort.
That's a dead one.
That's a dead, and if you...
And then... That's a live one.
The oysters are in cages made of lattices that bob on the surface of the water. Different sized oysters are in different containers, from youngest to most mature. Oyster farming has become more common as the traditional work of wild harvesting has declined, along with the area's oyster population. In 2013, the federal government declared the bay a fishery disaster, citing drought. Many people point to additional reasons for the bay's woes. Dredging, hurricanes, the water distribution wars with Georgia and Alabama, the 2010 BP oil spill, and overharvesting amid fears of that oil reaching the bay. Not everyone agrees on all of it. In the end, with fewer oysters left in the bay, fewer people made a living from the time-honored tradition of wild oyster harvesting. And slowly, families who had been tonguing for generations left the business. In 2020, the state closed the bay to wild oyster harvesting altogether. Now, 5 years later, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has approved a management plan for a partial reopening for wild oyster harvesting. It's set to start at the beginning of January and run through February, then pick up again with a normal fall season starting next October.
There's a lot of oysters, but it's not as good as it was. We don't have 10,000 acres like we used to. No, the areas that are growing oysters, which is mostly on the restoration sites, is really good. And we're going to have to take it easy, you know, for starts and until things start getting better.
Wayne Williams is president of the Florida Work and Water Mounds Association, which started in 2020 when the bay was closed. He's a wild-caught oyster mound by trade, but has been doing yard work until he can get back out on the water again. Williams was against closing the bay. Now he's wary of the FWC's proposal, which could limit the number of wild-caught oystermen in various ways.
We do not want a limited entry license. We do not want lotteries. And it's just so easy to open this bay to a low bag limit and let everyone go.
Cheryl Carr, treasurer of the Seafood Work and Watermen's Association, worries if the FWC doesn't fully reopen the bay, the few remaining wild-caught oyster harvesters will have to move on. And she's worried their traditions will go with them.
The fathers teaching the sons what the boats and those stories that you could ever hear on those boats you'll never hear again, because they're trying to just limit those folks to just a few.
Carr says traditional oystermen can't make a living if they're only allowed to harvest in small parts of the bay.
They need something. They can't just keep living like this.
But some environmentalists see it differently. They worry opening the bay to too many wild harvesters could stall the recovery that's been underway. Cameron Baxley serves as the Apalachicola River Keeper. Her job is advocating for the river and bay.
There's not a ton of oysters out there from what I've seen in the data. So I kind of feel like, for me, it's like inviting your whole family over for Christmas dinner and splitting a 10-piece chicken nugget meal. You know, you gotta be really careful about how you share everything.
The FWC says it will keep trying to restore Apalachicola Bay. They'll meet again in November to make a final decision on the reopening. I'm Margie Menzel.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Steve Newborn, Carrie Sheridan, and Derek Cam. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.